This is Interpreting Wine host and founder Lawrence Francis welcoming you to this, my Willamette Valley Winemaker Special. Across these 20 episodes recorded in quickfire fashion in January 2020, I got to meet a broad selection of people making wine in the region, both a variety of winemaking scale from the micro to the macro, and also different focuses that include different aging vessels, different grape varieties, sparkling wines, and of course different interpretations of Pinot. Episodes are going to be released in the order that they were recorded, so you'll get to be a virtual guest on the tour. Two things you can do to help spread this series even further. One is to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, either where you're listening or on your favorite podcast platform. And the second, the one that's really going to help push this out there, is to head to interpretingwine.com/iTunes and leave a review letting me know what you think. A genuine, huge, huge thank you in advance. Today's episode of the Willamette Valley Winemaker Special features Adam Campbell of Elk Cove Vineyards. A second-generation winemaker in the Willamette Valley, Adam reflects on the early days of the Oregon wine industry and his later transition into the business. He gives us a virtual tour of the properties from which they source their fruit, before a tasting of three wines, the 2018 Estate Riesling, the 2016 Goodrich Chardonnay, and the 2018 La Bohème Pinot Noir, before he tells us about the fascinating collaborative project with two other second-generation winemakers in the region, the 2GV Project. Enjoy!
My name is Adam Campbell, and I'm the owner and winemaker here at Elk Cove Vineyards. Really happy to be here on this podcast and to tell you a little bit about Elk Cove and my story about how I came to be here. My parents came here about, over 45 years ago, kind of in the one of the first waves of folks growing grapes and making wine in the Willamette Valley. They had a real history with Oregon in that I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. My grandfather was a pear farmer up in Hood River Valley, which is kind of at the base of Mount Hood. And his father was a dairyman that immigrated from Switzerland. And so we definitely had farming in our background, and my folks decided to do something different, and they'd heard about some very small wine grape production happening in the Willamette Valley, so they made the two-hour trek west to out here, and I feel really fortunate. I got to grow up here on a beautiful property, 200 acres, helping my mom plant grapevines, and my father quickly learned how to make wine, and I helped him in the winery through those early years. And I took over for them about just a little over 20 years ago. And I feel really fortunate that I had a hand in pretty much every vintage, but I get, to essentially take over for my father, and both my folks are still around, so they love to come visit, and we talk about wine, and we've grown a lot over the 50 years, and as has the Oregon wine industry. But I feel really fortunate to have been a part of it. Well, when I was a kid, I don't think there really was a lot of hope or even a forethought that it could be an amazing industry like it is today. I think my folks, they probably would have been, if you asked them their aspirations for the winery and vineyard here, they'd say sell a bit of wine out the cellar door and maybe in a few accounts in Portland. And it's been just amazing to be able to have been a part of not just Elk Cove's growth, but the whole growth of the industry here. When I was a kid going to farm school out here in Yamhill, all my friends, they were other farm kids, but and I thought I was one of the other farm kids, and only after getting teased a bit about your parents growing grapes and making wine did I realize that, my parents were pretty alternative, as were most of the folks in the early days. And so it was a really fun way to grow up. But yeah, we definitely weren't like the other farm kids. When I took over in the mid-90s, I think my folks were, you know, they put a lot of heart and soul into this project, and they were kind of ready for some new energy. So they very graciously retired and said, okay, Adam, it's up to you to take it on and make it what you want it to be. For me and my parents, I think we were really focused on how we could grow the grapes and essentially become all estate grown property. So in the early days, we would certainly buy grapes from other folks, and I'd worked with a lot of really nice growers in the Willamette Valley, but with that kind of singular goal of being an estate winery where you have full control from the ground up, from vine to bottle, we went on a big growth planting project where we expanded from our 50 acres on our estate property up here. And now we have 6 other properties, all within kind of a 15-mile radius, and have about 400 acres total in the ground. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Pinot Noir is primary to each of those sites and is the most important thing we do. But we've always had a passion for white wine. My father and mom, they both really they planted some of the first Riesling in this area that I still have amazing Riesling vines that I make wine from today. And expanding then into Pinot Gris, we'd always had Chardonnay as part of our mix. I love being able to make Pinot Noir as a primary thing, but then really push into these other cool climate white varieties. And even into some sparkling wines, which kind of expand what we do. There's nothing better than, you know, if I do a wine dinner or doing a tasting to pour 6 to 8 wines and to have every one really hit the mark. In some ways, that's the best compliment I can get if each of the wines really shine.
Yeah, and I can totally relate to that. And yeah, seeing the enjoyment because, yeah, even, yeah, being different from the other farm kids, I mean, it's something that always stands out to me, meaning as I do, you know, lots of winemakers, is just that, yeah, the agricultural part of it, the growing and the actual, yeah, being out in the field, doing that part well is so important. But you kind of go beyond the scope of so many other farmers, don't you, in that you know, that's almost the start of the process when you're pulling it out the ground. I guess a lot of those other farmers is then selling their produce, and you're just getting going, really, in terms of, yeah, the other, you know, 1,000 decisions and 1,000 choices that you have to make to make a sparkling or to make any of these other wine styles that you do. I think it would be really interesting, you know, given that growth over time and that acquisition of other properties, just to, yeah, talk to, you know, where are those grapes now coming from that may well be, yeah, sitting here in the tasting room and people might be enjoying out there. And yeah, it looks as though they're all in the Yamhill Carton AVA. So yeah, talk to us about the terroir, the situation in which those different areas, those different grape growing areas that you have find themselves.
Well, yeah, we actually have vineyards in a few different AVAs, but Chehalem Mountains and in a new one called Laurelwood. But really primary to Elk Cove, and the really origin of our story is in the Yamhill Carlton AVA. It's a AVA that was established in the early 2000s, but Elk Cove was the first vineyard and winery in this area. And one of the things that's really cool about our kind of Oregon, northern Willamette Valley vineyard sites is the soils are quite different from very short distances. So even just for us, all of our vineyards, as I said, are in 10 to 15 mile radius. But Elk Cove and our Mount Richmond vineyard, our Goodrich vineyard, those are all marine sediment soils. And they really produce a really distinct type of Pinot Noir. And we noticed big differences with these marine sediment soils compared to our other vineyards, which we have one called Clay Court on Jory soil that's over in the Parrot Mountain area of the Chehalem Mountains. And that's volcanic soil, a little bit like what they'd have in Dundee area.
Yeah.
And those are completely different wines too. And then kind of to finish it off, the third main soil type is a Laurelwood or Lust soil. It's blown in sedimentary origin, but not marine sedimentary. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, those are more earthy wines, more blue fruited wines. And I think as a winemaker, I just really love anything that connects me back to those vineyards. And you're right, when we're out, you know, and doing everything we do, the vineyard is really just truly the first stop on that journey. And yet I would say it's the most important. I'm a little biased that way. But I love the fact that we can grow our own grapes, can really make wines. And at the end of the day, we get to succeed or fail based on everything that we're doing. We have a value-added product, which is different than like my grandfather, who was a pear farmer, very much a commodity grower. With grapes, we can take those grapes, add value to them, make wine, and hope to bring joy to people all across the U.S. and export markets. And it's great to be able to put a little bit of Oregon out into the world of wine consumption.
Incredible to, yeah, really appreciate the diversity of the plantings that you have there, and the history. I think that being said, I think it comes together in the best place possible in the glass. So we've now got three of your wines in front of us, and I like the choices that you've made here in terms of the varietal. So take us from the land and the terroir now into the glass.
Great. So yeah, the first wine I'm really very excited to share with you is our Riesling. It's an estate Riesling from 2018 vintage. These are vines my parents planted in 1975, and we only use those old vines for this bottling. So it's quite a small bottling. And, you know, we think of these old vines in some ways, you know, they're like an old friend, right? I've known them for their whole life. And my father certainly made Riesling starting with our second vintage, and I have continued it every year since. It's a small part of what we do. We primarily focus on Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Pinot Gris. But when you have the opportunity to have old Riesling vines, and especially, you know, Riesling is a variety that in its youth is very prolific producer. It has a lot of vigor. It's why a lot of the wine world, you can get Rieslings for quite inexpensive that have high yields, and those are nice, friendly wines, maybe with a little bit of residual sugar. But this is something different in that these vines, because they're, again, going on 45 years old, they've started to set really small crops. They have a much smaller canopy. We actually encourage as much canopy as possible to help kind of shade the bunches from too much sun. But it's given us is a really an opportunity to make a very intense wine that even at, you know, quite a dry level, this has about 5 grams residual sugar, so quite low. And what we love about it, of course, as winemakers is I think pretty much every winemaker in Oregon is just super excited about the brightness and acidity of these wines. And there's nothing like Riesling in terms of nice, really bright acidity. In terms of drinking it, I just really love the kind of ripe apricot, kind of even peaches, definitely stone fruit kind of element to the aromatics. As aged wines, they definitely get a bit more of the diesel-y kind of petrol aromatic. But as young wines, it's all about that freshness and amazing food wine. Also, what a lot of folks don't know is it's an amazing age-worthy wine. In terms of sometimes our Rieslings will live longer than our Pinot Noirs. I was at a tasting the other day where we broke out a bottle of 1983 Riesling that my father had made. And it was still, you know, it still had freshness. It still had vibrancy. No other white wine we could produce would even hope to still be that lively at, 30 plus years.
Yeah, it's... I think it's really interesting to me, again, you know, trying to just reflect on what I'm seeing here over in the Willamette Valley is, and what I'm hearing as well. I think that's the thing, is so many people referring to these cool climate white varietals, these kind of varietals that are, you know, much more commonly found in Alsace or over in Germany. And I think it's really, you know, again, back to the power of wine to tell stories, because at the end of the day, the story that's being told out there, and, you know, with good reason, is around Pinot. You know, that's the calling card, if you like, and that's the one that's going out there into the world and winning so many plaudits. But I think it's great to then, yeah, to be able to get these bottles out there into people's hands, hopefully, you know, all over the States and all over the world, to just, yeah, tell that story that, yeah, the terroir, the land here, you know, there's really nothing quite like it, and it's so diverse, I think, that it's making, yeah, fantastic examples of riesling that you've just described here. And I guess, yeah, the only thing I would just say and add is, you know, it's again another one of those wines that it is age worthy, but, you know, it's just then a question of keeping your hands off it long enough to age, because it's drinking so nicely, it's so approachable, but yeah, it's got that beautiful acidity, it's got that, you know, incredible vibrancy that I'm finding in a lot of the wines here. So really liking this.
Well, we were just chatting about that kind of diesel-y petrol quality in Riesling, which we really love as an aged wine character. Obviously, our vintages in Oregon, just like the rest of the world, we've had warmer vintages, a lot hotter, a lot more sunlight through our summers, and we started noticing more of that quality earlier in their evolution as wines. And that's why we've gone to essentially kind of trying to hide the grapes just slightly. So having enough leaf canopy to basically hide the grapes from the sun in an effort to delay the onset of that petrol quality. If you think about wines, Rieslings from like Australia, which I love, but they have a lot of that character right away. Mm. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's just that much brighter and, you know, sunnier in that climate. So, you know, it's an example of climate and what we do in the vineyard really affecting what we have in the winery. I hopefully will have these old vine Riesling for many, many more years, but we've already started planting some newer blocks of Riesling. They don't go into this wine. I sell those grapes off because I'm just a bit obsessed with the old vine character that we get in this wine. So I'm really excited to show you our Goodrich Chardonnay. So this is the 2016 version. It's kind of an interesting story for me in terms of Chardonnay. My parents planted Chardonnay as their first variety. They planted Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And for them, really, Burgundy was the model. And they went down the path of making Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, quickly expanding into some Riesling and some other Alsatian varietals. And I guess just as a winemaker and a, you know, someone who's passionate about wine, I was much more excited about Alsace and Alsatian wines and spent a bit of time there. And it's interesting. So we started planting a lot of Pinot Gris, a lot of Riesling, a lot of Pinot Blanc. I have Gewürztraminer, all the great varieties of Alsace. And only more recently, I purchased this Goodrich vineyard back in 2014 from someone that had planted some Chardonnay. And I wasn't quite sure if I would keep it. I thought maybe I would graft it over to Pinot Noir or maybe even Pinot Gris or Riesling. And I chatted with the folks that were buying the grapes. It was Tony Soder and the folks over at Argyle, and they said, "Oh, don't rip out the Chardonnay. Those are top vines. You should jump into it again." So I hadn't actually made Chardonnay in almost 20 years because the Chardonnay my parents had planted, I'd grafted over to Pinot Noir, and so it was a re-exploration of a variety that was really important to my parents. Goodrich is an amazing site, but as a winemaker, I kind of had to kind of go back to school in terms of how I wanted to make this wine. I knew that there were some things that I really knew that I wanted to do. I wanted to focus on the freshness of the variety, the brightness of acidity, It's a warm site at Goodrich. It can often ripen quite early. And I think I went into it just really focusing on picking the grapes before the acidity went away. Mm. I didn't really care about sugar levels or what the finished alcohol would be. I thought as long as it has freshness, it's the right thing for me. So we picked early, but I think Chardonnay definitely needs French oak, not necessarily new oak, but we started experimenting with making the Chardonnay in larger format barrels. So now we have a big stable of 500 liter puncheons. This wine's, you know, maybe 20% new oak, but that's not really the important part of it. The large format barrels influence the wine with less oak immediately. And now we'll make wine in these puncheons. We've got some concrete eggs that we work with. It's kind of become a house favorite for us to drink at home. So we're excited about Chardonnay again.
Yeah, again, it's great to have Chardonnay back in the glass. You know, it feels like it's been a little while since I've been trying some on the trip. But I remember starting off with Chardonnay on the very first evening, and you know, it's again, I guess, you know, echoing the obvious, you know. But yeah, you're going to Burgundian varieties. You know, you've got the Pinot Noir, so why not have the Chardonnay? You know, I really like the description that you gave there, because, you know, I think the thing that stands out for me here is just there's an amazing integration, I would say. You know, the oak is there, and you know, it's again, you know, as everybody that kind of knows and loves Chardonnay that's had oak on it, you know, but this is very much that kind of caress of oak. You know, it's not so sort of forward, it's not so sort of in your face. It's back to, I think, what can be, yeah, a lifted example of Chardonnay when you have, yeah, kind of judicious use of oak, I want to say, not overdone, still in balance, still delicate, but yeah, still lifted and still obviously with lots of presence and lots of acidity, and I guess still lots of aging potential.
So yeah, I wouldn't want you to leave here without trying a Pinot Noir. I chose this one. This is a vineyard that's right here at the winery. So when you come visit Elk Cove, out from the tasting room is a beautiful vineyard going out west. It's 20 acres. It's called La Boheme. My parents planted it back in 1985. And their thing was really trying to hone in on the plant material. And we started with really good plant stock, Pommard clone. But their idea was to how to improve the clone. They went through many generations of going and looking at each vine and kind of marking the vines that had things that were important to us, which is like small clusters, small berries, ripening a little on the earlier side. And I think that we really see that in La Boheme, where it's, you know, essentially really tiny clusters, tiny berries, which as a winemaker, when I see that, that's when I know that in terms of fermentation and how I approach extraction, I know I can be so incredibly gentle with these wines. So with La Boheme, with these small clusters and small berries, I can go away from my usual program of maybe, you know, hand plunging or punching down twice a day. We would be able to, with La Boheme, some years, maybe every other day is all we would ever dig in and get the skins in contact with the juice, because we knew that with those small clusters and small berries, you were going to get so much flavor and aromatics. And at that point, you just kind of want to protect the, you know, the fruit and the softness of the wine. This is one of our oldest vineyards. It's not our oldest vines. We've got vineyards, obviously, back into the early 70s. But this is a really steep, high-elevation site that when my folks planted it, was probably on the marginal end of where we could even get grapes ripe. This is almost 800 feet in elevation. But of course, now with some warming trends going on in Oregon and the world, this vineyard is really, you know, it can retain freshness and vibrancy. It has all that kind of dark fruit and kind of sappy black cherry, and even like I think of this wine as having some Italian plum kind of fruit going on there, but kind of bound up with this real fresh freshness that you get. And it also is improved, I think, by this is a vineyard that's planted on its own roots, so it's not on rootstock. Most vineyards in Oregon now are on rootstock, which can kind of push the grapes along, and the own-rooted vines, maybe because they're old or maybe because they're on their own roots, they just kind of self-regulate. So when we get rain, they don't soak up the water. They don't split. The berries don't split. When we get super high heat, they don't kind of freak out as vines. They're just either because they're old vines or because the root systems are just so deep, they're easily self-regulating. I opened this. It's quite a young wine. This is 2018, but we're excited about the vintage. We're just now starting to think about, we'll probably release this wine in the next 3 to 6 months. And other than that, very traditional winemaking, you know, hand plunged once a day, maybe even less. It will rest in the best quality Burgundian coopered barrels that we can source, but not a large percentage of new oak, more about like 20 to 30%. Just really trying to kind of focus on the lovely fruit that we can get from you know, La Boheme, which is, you know, I think one of kind of the high water marks for our area in the Yamhill-Carlton district.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. I mean, you can probably hear me sort of, digesting it and, have it still quite persistent, I guess, you know, having just tried it around 30-odd seconds ago. I mean, I think that what I'd add over and above that is just, I think it's just to emphasize really just what that, I guess, developed root system is kind of giving it this wine. And it's interesting to hear you, you know, bring out the rootstock comparison. And yeah, just in a way that, you know, a lot of these single vineyard wines I've been trying here are showing up in the glass. It's just that there just feels like there's just so much more detail here. You know, because when you do have, I guess, a younger vine, you know, bringing back its information and its report of its region, you know, there's not as much information there. You know, there's so much more, as well as the fruit. The fruit is certainly there, but beyond that, you know, there are these sort of more herbal notes that I'm getting, almost like slightly mentholy notes, but this sort of like potpourri, I would say, of different herbs, and that the word that's coming to mind is detail. It just really, you know, really feels like it's a real sort of thorough exploration of that site. And you know, you've got those vines there going out and bringing that information, and then, you know, giving that to us through the wine. You know, not always my usual way to end interviews. You know, I want to just sort of invite you to kind of go in depth on a story you just kind of told me off mic, the 2GV project, if you like, which I think absolutely demonstrates and shows the collaboration, but then also just this idea of I think curiosity that I'm picking up as well, and people who are, you know, not afraid to explore the terroir that they've got, and I think in this case that, you know, some of their contemporaries have as well.
Yeah, from the very beginning of the Oregon wine industry, I think that all the folks really realized that it was much better to kind of team up. And I always think of it kind of like you might have part of the answer, but if you don't share and let other people in on what you've learned, you're not going to learn the other half of the answer. Project 2GV is a really fun one that basically it was three wineries that are all, you know, pioneer Oregon wineries run by second generation winemakers. So Elk Cove, Sokol Blosser, and Ponzi, all run by the second generation now. And we decided that in addition to our regular meetups where we, you know, talk winemaking, talk vineyards, collaborate on how to push the envelope in terms of winemaking and making better and better wine, we just decided to kind of formalize that with a program where we shared grapes from each of our vineyards. So for me, it was La Boheme. I sent 1 ton of La Boheme to my friend Luisa at Ponzi and 1 ton to my buddy Alex over at Sokolblasser. We each made wines, and they did the same with some of their top-notch historic vineyards as well. And really, what it allowed us to do is to make 9 different wines. Each of us made 3. We can then taste exactly the influence of the hand or the winemaker's influence versus the land or the terroir. And so it was really special for me to send a ton of grapes to Sokolblasser and Ponzi and really see what they could do with La Boheme. La Boheme's a vineyard that there's only 2 people that have ever made wines from La Boheme. That's me and my father. And it was fun. We sent them far afield and then really got back and we were able to taste them. We've been able to share that with some tastings in New York, and we plan on doing one in San Francisco, mostly with media folks, but we've also done it for some really great cellar club customers here in Oregon. And it's a great exploration, again, of hand versus land, and it also kind of formalizes and really pushes us to remember to collaborate, to give honor to these old vineyards, and I guess we wouldn't do it if it wasn't a lot of fun. So, I feel really fortunate when I think of, you know, all my best friends in the world are essentially folks that I've met through the Oregon wine industry, and some real long-term relationships with some folks that I grew up with and played with as kids, and now to see them do amazing work and to kind of collaborate and join up with me and pushing their own businesses and winemaking to the fullest extent, and also really continue the history of the Oregon collaborative efforts that our parents started.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's my absolute pleasure to bring your story to my listeners. I'm also so happy that we got to speak about the 2GV project and have included a web link direct to this project on your website below. Do see just below that for the main Elk Cove Vineyard website, where you can find details of all of the wines that we tried. As ever, if you're in the UK, these wines are not currently represented over there, and Elk Cove would like to be considered for representation. Next time on the Willamette Valley Winemaker Special, in episode 396, Adam passes the storytelling baton to Chris Williams, winemaker at Brooks. As we're now nearing the home straight of this Willamette Valley Winemaker Takeover, it's probably a good time to check out the special playlist I put together for the series, and to catch up on any episodes you might have missed, just head to interpretingwine.com/WVWA. It's also a perfect time to subscribe to the podcast so that you're alerted when the remaining episodes go live. And to do this, just head to interpretingwine.com/listen. As ever, I would love to have you following along with me on social media, where I'm at Interpreting Wine on Instagram and Facebook, at Wine Podcast on Twitter, and email hello@interpretingwine.com. See you next time.